It's time for another FAQ boo. This time it's from Emma Gatton, not to be confused with the last FAQ, which was Emma Glacken. Emma Gatton is at City University and she's doing some research into the democratisation of the media. This is one of those topics I'm going to enjoy getting my teeth into. So let's skip to the question anyway. The question is, do I think new media, social networking, Twitter, YouTube, etc., democratises the media? Or is there ever a danger of crowding out expertise or perhaps having just a lot of noise? Right, I think there's two parts to this. First of all, let's pick apart the idea of democracy. In these kind of discussions about democratising the media, you often get people saying, yes, but people who use web tools, who use the internet, are not representative of the population as a whole. You know, not everyone has access to the internet, and so on. And this is true, and it's a valid point. But I want to pick apart some of the complexities in this issue, really. First of all, there's this assumption that democracy itself gives a vote to everyone. It doesn't. People under 18, for example, can't vote. In some countries, people in prison can't vote. So we already do limit who has a vote. Secondly, a significant proportion of people choose not to exercise their vote. And likewise, with the internet, there is a significant proportion of people who don't have access to the internet who choose not to. It's not because they can't have access to the internet, but if you look at the research into people who don't have access to the internet, you'll see there's a significant body who are resistant to it, who don't see any reason to use it, who actively object to it. So it's more complex than I think sometimes it's painted. Now, for all of that, I think this idea of democratisation is misleading anyway. I don't think that new media does democratise the media as such. I think it gives more people access to the media, and in that sense it's similar in a way. I think the closest similarity is when the vote was extended. If you think back to the vote in the UK, let's say about 200-300 years ago, you know, you were only entitled to vote if you were a man, if you had property of a certain value, and passed certain other tests. And over time, that was extended. Now, you could make an argument that the same is starting to happen with the media. So to have access to the media, to have a voice in the media, in the same way as you have a voice in democracy, you had to have a certain size of publishing operation. Quite often, you were male as well. Now, it wasn't explicitly limited in the same way that the franchise of the vote was, but it's an interesting analogy to make. And certainly I think it's a good thing that more people have access to the media, that more people have a vote in the national conversation and the public sphere, if you like, which is really integral to the idea of democratic operation. You know, if you look at the rise of the public sphere, it coincides with the expansion of the franchise, of the voting franchise. But, as I said, I think this idea of democratisation is actually misleading, and I'll tell you why. I think it's more a meritocratisation, if that is a word. It's more about meritocracy. In other words, to some extent, and I'm not saying completely, but to some extent, the ability to be heard in the media now rests to some extent more on merit than it used to. So, you know, if you've got an important story to tell, if you've got a point to make, or if you can pick out a flaw in something else, if you can fact check someone else's ass, so to speak, then it's more likely that you will be heard now. Before, you know, it wasn't so much a meritocracy as a kind of an aristocracy. of people who had been employed by publishers, who had the money to set up publishing operations and so on. So in that sense, I think the idea of a meritocracy is probably better as an analogy. But as I said, I don't think that's entirely the case. There's a lot of buts in this boo, isn't there? Because the other factor you have to look at in online publishing is network effects. The first person to set up a blog on a particular subject or a website on a particular subject will kind of amass more traffic and more reputation and more Google page rank and more attention simply by virtue of the fact that they were first. It's kind of a feedback loop, if you like. So, and you'll see this time and time again, the alpha bloggers, if you like, you know, there's a window of opportunity for people to become alpha bloggers, and after a certain point it's very hard to get into that place, you know, unless you find a new niche. So that I think is an important factor to take into account, and it's one that is, you know, not particularly widely understood. It's not particularly widely talked about, but network effects, I think, are a really crucial element in any discussion of the democratization of the media, or the meritocratization, or whatever you want to call it. But, you know, this idea of widening the public sphere, of having more voices, I think has to be a good thing, you know, regardless of any ideas of whether people who use the internet are representative or not. You know, as I've talked about at length on my blog, you know, the people who had access to the media generally have never been representative. So you can't kind of criticise the new world order without looking at the old world order and thinking, well, actually, was that any better? And I think this probably takes me on to your second point, which is about noise. Is there a danger of crowding out expertise or perhaps having just a lot of noise? Well, you know, if you look at the internet from a distance, it is noise, but that's from a distance. If you look at it up close, if you're actually using it, then chances are there'll be some sort of filters in place which help you navigate that, which help you find the signal from the noise. Google itself is a classic filter. You know, Google, every time you do a search on Google, it is filtering out the noise and looking for the signal related most directly to the question you're asking by looking at how many links are pointing to sites, by looking at the content of all sites and so on. So it's quite an efficient way of doing that. Likewise, social networks act as a filter, so your friends, people who share your interests, will pass on interesting pieces of information and filter the signal from the noise. So the danger of there being too much noise, I don't think that's really the case. You know, there has always been a discourse around information overload, and you know, if you learn how to use these tools, then chances are you're going to find the signal from the noise. It doesn't take much effort, and like I say, Google, even at the most basic level, is doing that for you. But the other point you make is the danger of crowding out expertise. I don't think there is a danger of crowding out expertise. I think the experience shows that expertise is of huge value online. You look at things like bad science, you look at you know, things that get shared around. There's a lot talked about gossip and hearsay and how they get passed around online, but actually, possibly more so, what really gets passed around is the debunking stuff, is the expertise, is people who've had personal experience, people who are genuine experts rather than just journalists. And having access to that expertise firsthand without having to go through the intermediary of a journalist who's going to translate it for a mass audience and might not understand it entirely themselves, I think that's a really exciting aspect of the internet. So I don't think there's a danger of crowding out expertise. I think, if anything, it raises the bar. It raises the bar for journalists and basically says, you know, you can't wing it anymore. And to some extent, you have to acknowledge that you're not going to be an expert in everything, and that perhaps the journalist's role is more to provide a platform to verify